Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
All right, welcome. Welcome to Me Too and Beyond, continuing to tell the truth. I'm going to introduce our illustrious panel today, my notes are out of order, so forgive me. All right, we're going to start with T. Christian Miller, who is a senior reporter for ProPublica and winner of the 2016 Pulitzer Prize, shared with Ken Armstrong of the Marshall Project for their coverage of sexual assault. You may have read the story. It was incredibly powerful, an unbelievable story of rape. Or you might have heard it on This American Life, an episode called Anatomy of Doubt. That reporting was expanded into Miller and Armstrong's book, False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. So welcome T. Christian Miller. And then we have Bernice Jung. She's a reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, where she covers race and gender. Since 2012, she's been reporting on workplace sexual assault of farm workers and night shift janitors. Her new book, In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against American Workers, draws on her in-depth reporting. There we go. Next, we have Saru Jayaraman. She's the director of the Food Labor Center at Berkeley, and she's the co-founder and president of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which its mission is to improve wages and working conditions for the nation's workforce working in the food service industry. It was founded after 9/11 with displaced World Trade Center workers. 73 workers at the windows on the World Restaurant were killed on 9/11. 250 were left without jobs. Now the ROC represents over 2,500 people. Saru has shown a light on sexual harassment and violence in the food service industry. You might remember her last year from the Golden Globes when she walked the red carpet as Amy Poehler's guest as part of the Time's Up initiative. And finally, we have Winnie M. Lee, a writer, producer, and activist, a frequent backpacker and world traveler. She's been engaged in film and literature across the world, producing, teaching, and writing. Her first novel, A Dark Chapter, tells the story of Vivian, a strong and independent woman who goes through a violent, traumatic sexual assault. It's the story of what happens, and it's not just the story of the assault itself, it's the story of what happens after, and the incomplete and sometimes inadequate responses of the healthcare system, the criminal justice system, and beyond. It's a powerful story of survival drawn from Lee's own experience as a survivor of a violent sexual assault. So I wanted to start us off. Obviously, if you read the description of this event, it asked a provocative question. Me too, has it gone too far? So before we kind of get into that a little bit, or has it not gone far enough, I wanted to ask, and I have to introduce myself too. I'm Sandhya Dirks. I'm a reporter with KQED Public Radio. I cover race and equity. So I wanted to ask each of our authors to talk about and describe a little bit of their own work and how it intersects with the Me Too movement. I'm it right down the way.
So I'm an investigative reporter by trade, by profession, and I work for a company called ProPublica. I don't hold myself out to be by any means an expert in sexual assault or rape, but I am a journalist who has been very interested in the topic for a very long time. And so a couple years ago, when my co-author Ken Armstrong and I joined forces, we wanted to look specifically at the issue of women who come forward to report their rape or their sexual assault, but then aren't believed. And what does that look like in person? And so our book sort of focused on the issue of when a woman comes forward, how does she react, how does she respond, and how do police and prosecutors specifically respond to that? So in some ways, our book isn't quite, the Me Too movement is interesting because it includes both women who are coming forward without having ever gone to the police just to say, I am also a victim of sexual assault here. But it also includes women who are now, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not you see an uptick in the increase of reporting to official authorities about sexual assault and violence. I don't think we know that yet, but that's where I would hope that that the movement and my interest in sort of law enforcement issues and the courtroom journey that rape victims have to go through, those two intersect, I think. And it's going to be very interesting to see if the momentum in the Me Too movement carries out in a way that makes it look different on the law enforcement side of things. Do we suddenly start seeing more arrests for sexual assault? Do we begin seeing more prosecutions and convictions of sexual assault? Because I think, as folks in this room probably know, the statistics are pretty abysmal about that, and depending on who you look at, there's only about 1 in 100 rape reports actually makes, or sexual violence incidents, actually all makes it all the way through the courtroom system to some kind of a verdict of one way or the other.
So I'm Bernice, and I work for another nonprofit investigative journalism outfit called Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And since about 2012 or so, I've been working with a team of reporters at UC Berkeley and KQED looking at extreme sexual harassment among farm workers and night shift janitors. And so it's been really interesting to reflect on Me Too, because this is some reporting that we've been doing for 5-6 years now. And it's been an issue that I think has, even with our efforts to kind of chronicle the types of abuses that women face routinely in low-wage work, immigrant women in particular, you know, it was never an issue that really kind of broke into the mainstream or got the attention of, you know, many politicians and the public. And so it's been fascinating to see now this kind of the dam break and see so much attention paid to this issue. And so I've actually, in the process, talked to a lot of farm workers and night shift janitors and others that I've interviewed over the years to ask them what they think about Me Too. And a lot of them tell me that they think that it's just so tremendous that, you know, with the Me Too movement, such a, you know, terrible taboo is being kind of shattered in this important way, and more people are coming forward and willing to share their stories and, you know, just speak out in this really powerful way. But they've also asked me, you know, why do you think that nobody really paid attention when we were speaking out? And I think that's, you know, a really fair question that I continue to ask.
Hi, how's everybody? My name is Saru, and as you heard, I represent the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. We actually have 30,000 workers across America, 500 restaurant owners, and about 23,000 consumer members in 10 states. We're a national organization fighting for better wages and working conditions in this industry. We've been working on this issue for almost 2 decades now. And our growth as an organization has really paralleled the explosion in the restaurant industry. It is right now the second largest and absolute fastest growing private sector employer in the United States. We're almost at 13 million workers, so that 1 in 11 American women has worked in the industry. It works in the industry right now, and 1 in 2 Americans, so 1 in 2 of us, and I always love to ask, 1 in 2 of us has worked in the industry at some point in their lifetime. How many people in this room have worked in the restaurant industry at some point in their life? So, I mean, this is actually less than what I typically get, but it's everybody. Everybody works in this industry, and yet we are the absolute lowest paying employer in the United States. So every year the Department of Labor puts out a list of the 10 lowest paying jobs. Every year 7 of the 10 are restaurant jobs in one occupation, one industry. We are the absolute lowest paying employer, and that is due to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which represents the chains. We call it the other NRA. And in doing research for my last book, Forked, which I don't know if it's on sale here. It is? Okay, great, thanks. But we uncovered that it's actually been around since emancipation, and that in fact, tipping originated in feudal Europe, came to the States right around the time of emancipation, and the Restaurant Association demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything at all and let them live on tips, which was a mutation of the feudal concept, which was tips always on top of wages rather than instead of wages. But that idea that tips could replace wages because it was a mostly black former slave workforce actually was codified into law in 1938, so we started with a $0 wage for a mostly black female workforce in 1938 as part of the New Deal. We went from $0 in 1938 to the current federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the United States of $2.13 an hour. And we're not talking about a minuscule population. I'm telling you, it's the largest employer of women in America, and it pays $2.13 an hour. And today, 70% of tipped workers are women. They largely work in IHOPs and Applebee's and casual restaurants across America. They obviously suffer from 3 times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce, even when you take tips into account. And they have the highest rates of sexual harassment, literally and statistically, of any industry in the United States. And it's because they are forced to tolerate all kinds of inappropriate customer behavior to feed their families and tips. Now, we have done so much research, you know, over the last 20 years, really, but in the last year with Me Too and Time's Up, we've had an overwhelming number of stories that have helped us understand that, look, in our industry, it isn't because women are living on tips, it isn't, women aren't told to tolerate harassment. No, they're told to encourage it. So managers tell women, dress more sexy, you know, wear tighter clothing, show more cleavage in order to make more money in tips. And because this is the first job for most of us, this is the first job for most women in America, in high school, college, or graduate school, it isn't just the fact that we have the highest rates of harassment for our own workforce. It's the fact that this is how women in America are introduced to the world of work, and it increases their tolerance for harassment later in life. So that we're putting out a report next week, actually, documenting how women in so many sectors, from the Hollywood actresses I've been working with since Me Too through Time's Up, to politicians, to women in corporate America, to academia, philanthropy, in every sector, women tell us, I've been sexually harassed more recently in my career, but I didn't do anything about it because it was never as bad as it was when I was a young woman working in restaurants, which means our industry sets the standard. And so there are 7 states that got rid of this abysmal wage and this legacy of slavery many decades ago, including California. They have higher restaurant sales per capita, higher job growth in the industry, higher rates of tipping, and half the rate of sexual harassment, which to me is the greatest evidence that I've seen in any sector that this is fundamentally about power. That when you pay a woman an actual wage rather than forcing her to rely on tips, she doesn't have to put up with anything and everything from the customer. She doesn't have to tolerate the abuse. She can actually reject it because she knows she's taking home some income to feed her family. So we've been calling on every state and Congress to repeat what California and the 7 states have done. We call it One Fair Wage. And thanks to Me Too and Time's Up and all the press we've gotten, Governor Cuomo announced earlier this year that he would make New York the 8th state in the union to eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers. And we've got this on the ballot now, thank you, in D.C. and Michigan, and we've got legislators in 12 other states looking to replicate. So we are driving a truck through the Me Too moment because we think time is up, absolutely, on this legacy of slavery and this source of the worst harassment of any industry. And we will not stop until every woman in America actually gets a wage rather than having to be forced to live on tips. And I just want to say in closing that I think one of the parts that's been a little frustrating for us is in all the talk about sexual harassment, there's been very little talk of the corporate actors that really have created the problem, the corporate structures that control our democracy and control the way in which women are treated and paid in America. It's been so much talk about this issue as if it's sort of organic and the nature of gender dynamics in America, and ignoring really protagonists who have made it so.
Hi, so I'm Winnie, and T. Christian Miller, despite winning a Pulitzer Prize, introduced himself as not an expert on sexual assault. I would say I am an expert in sexual assault because I am a survivor, and I think a lot of the work I do as an activist and as an author and a researcher now is on bringing the survivor story front and center and recognizing that survivors are a source of expertise on this issue, right? Because we've lived through it. Some of us have gone through the whole experience of trying to pursue criminal justice. And it's not just the criminal justice system, it's about how, you know, the medical institutions treat us, it's about how friends and family treat us, it's about how this issue is perceived and portrayed in the mainstream media. So the work I do is very much about trying to encourage and, you know, create survivor-informed research, survivor-informed narratives, survivor-informed policy out there, because if we're going to listen to the survivors, and hopefully we'll be able to create structural change in our institutions to better handle handle survivors to better, you know, respond to their needs and also to try to prevent future assaults and forms of harassment taking place. Unlike the other people on this panel, I'm a fiction writer. I also write bits of journalism, but my book, Dark Chapter, is a fictional retelling of my rape. Very briefly, 10 years ago in Belfast, Northern Ireland. I live in London, by the way, but I'm originally from New Jersey. But in Belfast, Northern Ireland, I was walking through a park on a beautiful sunny day in the spring, and I was followed by a stranger who then stalked me, and then I was violently assaulted and raped that afternoon. And that stranger was a 15-year-old boy, and my the story of my rape was kind of all over the news within that evening and over the next few weeks. So it was very strange for me as a writer. I used to work in the film industry as somebody who was engaged in, I suppose, the world of storytelling, to then see my own story being told by complete strangers. And of course, my name wasn't being mentioned. And it was almost like sort of a whole elision of my own identity as a person, because if you read a news story about a rape, you know, generally the victim's name is not mentioned for legal reasons. And you never really get a sense of that person existing outside the moment of the violence. So the headlines around my rape were, you know, Chinese tourists, obviously I'm American, but, you know, Chinese tourists brutally raped in park by teenage boy, right? So it was kind of going for, like, sort of the most salacious way of reporting a story, which was obviously very personal and private to me. And I just remember, you know, listening 2 days after my assault, just like Googling, you know, rape West Belfast, because I'm curious, right? I saw all these news headlines about my rape, and I listened to like a 30-minute radio chat show on the Stephen Nolan show about my rape. Did that mean was Belfast still a safe city? And it was just incredibly surreal to hear all these complete strangers talking about my rape. And I remember thinking, okay, in all of this conversation, where is there any space for my voice as a survivor? And there was almost an expectation that as a survivor or as a victim of that kind of crime, like, I wouldn't want to speak up. I was going to live the rest of my life in shame. And there was even a woman who said, oh, my heart goes out to that wee Chinese girl. because, I mean, I'm not going to fake the Northern Irish accent. My heart goes out to that wee Chinese girl because her life is now ruined. And I remember thinking, okay, well, that's a little bit insulting. But I know it was like coming from a place of sympathy, I suppose, for the poor rape victim. But at the same time, I was like, she doesn't know me, right? And so I know, like, you know, she's trying to ultimately, you know, be on my side. But, I mean, who is she to judge that my life is now going to be ruined because of something a complete stranger did to me? So I suppose all the work I've been doing since then has been about trying to change that image of the rape victim and survivor. And yes, we're on the receiving end of violence, which does change the course of our lives, but we also do have the expertise and the knowledge to try to change the public narrative about these issues. And in writing Dark Chapter, I wanted to interweave the story of a victim who's very similar to me, Vivian, with the story of that perpetrator. And again, my perpetrator was a 15-year-old boy. It turned out, you know, he hadn't had much of an education. He was illiterate. He was from the Irish traveler community, which is very prejudiced. There's a lot of prejudice against that community. They're often associated with crime. So in some ways, you almost had like two stereotypes, like Chinese tourist, right? And then like Irish traveler boy. And I kind of wanted to write a story that presented them as three-dimensional characters and looked at their lives from childhood leading up to that moment and how their whole lives were changed by it afterwards. So going through the entire criminal justice system, the way the media reported both of them, and how all the different public institutions treated them, not just because they were a rape survivor and rape victim and rape perpetrator or rapist, but also because, you know, she was Chinese looking, right? And then he was an Irish traveler, and all the different ways in which our identity is judged by factors that are outside of our control, our race, our class, our education level, and all the different ways in which our identity is then challenged when we suddenly find ourselves to become rape victim and or when we ourselves decide to commit a rape, right? And I kind of felt we've never actually looked at a fictional attempt to look into the mind of a rapist. And so for me, it was sort of an attempt to kind of reimagine what the life of that 15-year-old boy had been like. What were his attitudes? How did he learn those attitudes about women and girls? How did he absorb that kind of violence? And did he ever really think about the impact of his actions on my life? So that's a really interesting question for me. I mean, so for me too, obviously all the work I do is very much intersects with what is happening here. And I think, you know, it's great that Me Too is happening. I think it needs to go further and we need to go beyond that. We really do need to look at the the mindsets and the behaviors of perpetrators, because this crime wouldn't be happening in the first place if it weren't for perpetrators. So all the kind of structural inequalities that we've been researching here, which encourage that kind of perpetration, it obviously isn't just sexual violence. It's sexual violence is on a spectrum of misogynistic behavior, so it kind of starts oftentimes with sexual harassment. And I think we really need to look at all the structures that exist and encourage this kind of behavior and figure out how can we change that. And I think we're better off changing that if we're listening to the stories of survivors.
Thank you guys so much. So you guys sort of arranged yourself in this way where we have the journalists here and then we have the activists and survivor down there. So I kind of love that. And it actually goes to, I want to ask both sides of this equation kind of different questions. Let me start off with the journalists. And I wanted to ask you guys, how has reporting on rape and sexual assault changed? And I know that you referred to a case in Des Moines where a survivor actually wanted to be named, and how that changed the way in which we began to view victims as not victims but as survivors. And I wanted to ask you guys about sort of that change in the reporting on sexual assault, sexual violence, and also what is important as a journalist to think about and balance when you're hearing these incredibly personal stories with the reporting that you're trying to do.
I can talk about that because that 1992 story in the Des Moines Register was really kind of a watershed moment in the coverage of sexual assault by journalists. Just really briefly, all throughout most of kind of journalism history in the 1800s and 1900s, rape victims' names were routinely used. The articles were fairly lurid, and they would talk about a young woman was raped in this part of San Francisco, but they would always use her name. And then in the 60s and 70s, largely as a result of the feminist movement and the concern about the stigma and attaching a name, names began to phase out. And so it's actually not the case that we're legally prevented from, news organizations are not legally prevented from using rape victims' names. It's a convention that exists in the industry that's widely, perhaps the most widely single adopted consensus is that you do not use or publish the name of children and victims of rape. But that's an entirely, usually the reporter knows the name of the person because you're reporting on where the incident happened, you're talking to family and friends, you're talking to police, so usually somewhere along the way you do know the name of the victim, and that's withheld by just this consensus in the industry that this is the best way to go. In 1992, Geneva Overholzer, who was an editor of the Des Moines Register, was approached by a woman who wanted her name to be used because she felt like shouldn't be a stigma attached to using your name, and that it should be just like any other crime, like an assault or mugging. So why do I get this special treatment? And so they together worked and did this story, which I was in Berkeley, and was reading cover to cover, and it was so fascinating to me that this would it was such a progressive moment for journalism, an organization to take, right? So. But in those days, even then, it wasn't like this woman came forward as a Me Too person might, having never gone to the police. This woman had been to the police, her case had been adjudicated, and then it was after that she decided to use her name. And so you have the benefit, the publication of the benefit of having the entire story sort of like vetted and witnesses on both sides. And that's really remained the standard in journalism for many, many years, is that you, at least I as a young reporter, would have a difficult time making a pitch for a story of a woman who'd been sexually assaulted or raped that hadn't gone to the police. For both the reasons that there is actually libel reasons, and once you get a document from the police which says a woman has been raped, it makes it easier to report on in terms of a legal sense. But it's also just like the idea that like, why would I do a story about a woman who didn't talk to the police? And that was, I can count on many hands the times when there was a debate about that and how we would cover that story, and almost never did it end up being you would do a story about that. Now that's changed dramatically, and I think for the better, so that now you have seen, really beginning with the New York Times and New Yorker's coverage, a willingness to say, you don't have to go to the cops, we will believe your story. But there are still limits even to that today, so that I would say the current standard of practice that journalists are using now in telling stories, it usually involves a pattern. So it's not like a one-off situation. It usually you have to have like 3 or 4 or 5, I don't know what the magic number is, but there's generally a requirement to have more than a single person reporting an allegation. And then there's also a focus on outcry witnesses, which is the idea that you're talking to people that that person spoke to at the contemporaneous moment. So like she texted her friends, she told her boyfriend, whatever it was. So that's going to cover a lot more sexual assaults than previously, certainly. But we're still not at a point where every sexual assault is going to be covered. And that's still something that we're very much dealing with. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and Bernice and I talked about this briefly, is this is a moment when you have so many women who are now coming forward because they're kind of energized and believe in the Me Too movement. The reality is, you know, we're going to go on with our notebooks and cameras later, and you will be forever on the internet as a woman who was raped by somebody. And what responsibility is attached to journalists to communicate very clearly to the victims who want to come forward, like, that's great, but you should know that there are horrible people out there today that are not going away anytime soon, who will be able to look you up in 5 years, 2 years, 3 years, and is that something, are you still willing to be able to go forward to it? And I think it's really incumbent upon journalists to make it clear to their subjects, to the people who they're interviewing, that like, I know you're doing this for all the great reasons, I support you completely, but I have a duty, I think you have an affirmative duty to say, we have seen what happens to other women who come forward. It's not always a pretty story.
And I agree with everything that T just said. I think the one thing that I would add is that, we do as reporters have certain considerations around fairness and balance and reaching out to all sides when it comes to, doing the reporting. And so as an example, when looking at the farm workers, we were looking for really creative ways to find people who might not have reported to the police or might not have filed a lawsuit. And we did a call out on Spanish language radio. This is back in 2012 or so. Some of my colleagues went, and it was a Spanish language program that was listened to by farm workers across the country. And we got these phone calls in, and some of my colleagues literally ran out the door and got in the car and drove over to start to talk to some of the people that had called in. They had very compelling stories. They were very believable. But we ran into a significant problem for us as reporters, which was they couldn't always remember the name of the supervisor that had harassed them or worse, because nicknames are very common in the fields. The other problem was farm labor contractors were often their employers, and they weren't sure if their employer was the farm that they worked at or the farm labor contractor that was on their paycheck. And so it became very difficult for us to get underneath the story and unpack it, because our duty was to go and seek out the employer, the grower, the accused supervisor, and ask them and put the questions to them and put the accusations to them. So I think that's a space where, again, even if we want to do reporting on undocumented cases, or we have every reason to believe that someone is telling us the truth, there's a lot of vetting that has to go into it, because as we all know, if you do a story and it's not vetted, there can be serious problems for both the survivor and everybody else involved. I think I'm, not interested in casting aspersions, but obviously the Rolling Stone UVA story is a cautionary tale, that it is our job as journalists to really unpack the story and look at it holistically.
Absolutely. And for the other side of the table, so I'm wondering how you approach writing and talking and telling people about sexual assault and sexual violence differently. And I'm also wondering what journalists get wrong. So what can we learn from that we're missing right now?
I mean, so in the UK, where I live, I'm involved in a charity called On Road Media, and we're one of our, so the project that I'm working on is improving media coverage of sexual abuse and domestic violence. And I think, and I'm also doing my PhD research on that. So a lot of the work I do is with other survivors who are, keen to, share their story and also, on some level start to engage with the media. And I guess the question is, is engaging with the media a form of activism, right? Because if activism, especially around this issue, is about sharing your story and getting it out there, the media is a great amplifier, right? And in some ways, your story isn't really going to get out there unless you're using social media or mainstream media in some ways. But there is a lot of cynicism and kind of fear of engaging with journalists, right? Because and I've had this experience myself. I mean, my own rape was reported from the day of the rape, and so my own experience of sexual violence has always been intertwined with the media, right? And at first, I was very much a passive person there because, you know, newspapers were reporting on my rape and, nobody was trying to get a quote from me. And then eventually it became this relationship of learning how to speak to journalists and learning how to, I suppose, claim a certain amount of agency and control over the way that my story was being told. So now I will negotiate with them on the headline. You know, I'm always like, you know, make sure you use the word survivor, not victim. But there is a lot of fear in terms of engaging with the media and feeling that journalists are going to exploit you and they're going to take your experience and just put it out there, and there's not going to be any of that kind of duty of care that you spoke about, T. So I think there is certainly an ethical responsibility for journalists. And you can't just treat the victim that you're speaking to as a story that that's going to advance your career and give you that byline, and not really care about the impact it's going to have on victims. Especially when it comes to television, I know a lot of survivors who have felt very hard done by in terms of the way that their experience was portrayed by the media. One thing that most survivors kind of chafe against is, you know, your classic, story about rape, and then there's like a picture of a woman, you know, and either she's in profile and like her voice is kind of distorted in some way, or you can't see her face, or there's always a picture of like a woman in a corner, like, you know, and it's always this image of like abject misery, right? And victimhood and vulnerability. And yes, that is part of the experience. I mean, for sure, I was crying a lot for many years, but, you know, there's also the other side, which is that you can recover from that, and sharing your story or speaking out is actually sort of an act of, I don't know, people always call me brave, I suppose, but it's an act of trying to reclaim a narrative which is very personal to you, and so it's important not to show the victim as always just completely being a victim and being helpless, but, you know, there is quite a lot of strength and resilience in the stories of survivors, and so trying to change that image, I think, is really important as well.
So you asked first how we tell stories, and then I'll talk about what I think more can be done by journalists. So how we tell stories is actually allowing women to tell their own stories rather than anybody else telling their story for them. So for 20 years, we've been engaged in what's called participatory research, where we've put out like 60 or 70 reports and 3 books on these issues, and it's all been done by workers interviewing each other, surveying each other, being trained to actually go out, ask each other questions, and document what's happening. We've done 10,000 surveys of workers across the country in this way, and interviews, you know, in the thousands as well. And all of that is the basis for all of the research that we put out. It's women actually and workers actually telling their own stories. So that actually, all the research that we've done has been the basis for all of the press that we've gotten over the last 6 months. I mean, I wouldn't have been at the Golden Globes, and we wouldn't have been, you know, covered in all the press coverage that we got if it hadn't been for all that research we'd been doing for 16 years that was really based on workers telling their own stories and actually showing the connection between living on tips and suffering from sexual harassment and living on the subminimum wage and suffering from sexual harassment. So it was all based on women telling their own stories. I give the press a lot of credit, and I feel like nobody ever does. So I give journalists a lot of credit for actually picking up over the last 6 months on all the research we've put out. And, you know, we've been covered. There was, I don't know if you all saw, a very big spread in the New York Times about our work, videos of women talking about sexual harassment and living on tips. We were on Bill Maher and 60 Minutes in 2020. And all of that has been fabulous, and I give journalists a lot of credit for lifting up this research we've done for 16 years, 20 years, and nobody's really, there has been press, but not enough. And I think there's room for more. So the areas that I think have really been missing are, again, I'm going to come back to really looking at the structural issues that underlie all of this. You know, yes, we need to hear from victims. Yes, we need to talk about, let them tell their stories. We need to, you know, say what's happening. We need to identify bad actors. And all of that is wonderful and not enough because it doesn't get at the structural, real, as I said, corporate and other actors that have created the structural inequities that result in women having to live on tips, having to suffer from sexual harassment in the largest and fastest growing industries in America. So just as some quick examples, the New York Times piece was amazing. If you haven't seen it, it's called The Tipping Equation. It was a huge spread on tips and sexual harassment. But one thing that was really painful to us is that while it talked about the fact that you know, you, it said, you know, some advocates like Rock are saying paying women the full minimum wage would actually make a huge difference. Then they interviewed an asked an individual woman, do you think it would make a difference? And she said, I don't know, men are going to be men. And it failed to mention the biggest kind of finding of our research, which is that the 7 states that require the industry to pay the full minimum wage actually have half the rate of sexual harassment. And so they did publish a follow-up letter to the editor afterwards from me saying, you missed the key data point that shows this is about a structural inequity. And they did print that, but that was one thing that was missing. Similarly, on 60 Minutes, it was Leslie Stahl doing a piece on pay inequity, and they included us as to show how pay inequity in our industry is directly related to sexual harassment, and then ended up putting us in 60 Minutes overtime and having all of the pay inequity coverage be about women in corporate America, which I thought was a travesty because it continues to portray pay inequity, which is directly related to sexual harassment for low-wage women, as something that only women in higher income jobs experience, which is it's a travesty for the women's equity movement. And so these are the kinds of ways in which I feel like the structural inequities are not covered. And then I would say the biggest piece that's missing is, you know, coverage of women as protagonists, not just telling their stories, which I think is important, but actually standing up and fighting and organizing for change as they're doing with us. So in our case, we've got thousands of women across America who are standing up, fighting for what we call one fair wage, and being attacked very severely by the Restaurant Association. We call it our Davida versus Goliath, or Daniela versus Goliath, or Derica versus Goliath fight. We are up against the most powerful trade lobby for employers in the United States. And women are standing up and saying, time is up. You know, we've created this whole campaign called We're Not on the Menu. We're not on the menu. We're not on the menu. You don't sell us along with the food. But that is what women are being asked to do across America. And the Restaurant Association is attacking me and these women very, very vitriolically. So we, on Friday, had a huge hearing. 200 women showed up. Restaurant Association brought out 200 mostly white restaurant owners and some workers that they had co-opted. And these people, we were at a press conference, women were sharing their stories, and these people came and these men, white men, surrounding our women and shouting them down so they couldn't have their press conference. And this is the kind of very aggressive behavior that our women are up against. They've put our phone numbers up on their Facebook pages and they call us constantly harassing us saying, you're using sexual harassment to raise wages. God forbid we raise wages above $2.13 an hour. They put my kids' pictures up on attack websites. I mean, we're in a fight. We're in a fight for women and for the future of America, and that is not being covered at all. We continue to hear victim stories, which are fabulous. We need to hear more of that. But the fight, when women are protagonists fighting for structural change, you don't see that anywhere, and that's what's really missing.
Thank you so much, guys. One of the things we're talking about is all these kind of different intersections, right? So not just Me Too and sexual assault, but being very aware of who the women were who tipped the scale in the Me Too movement, and that they were white women, they were women in Hollywood, they were women with power, with public power, social currency, women who look a certain way, women who make a certain amount of money. And it definitely, that was part of what kind of brought that moment differently, right? Many of you work and cover women who are in very different places and stand at very different intersections, whether that be race or class, whether it's where they work, whether it's working as a farm worker, working in the restaurant industry. I wanted to ask how especially I think for Bernice and Saru, how we can take this moment and transform it from this is what happened to the Hollywood starlets, into this is what's happening to the most vulnerable women in the most shadowed corners of our country. So,
well, I think, you know, as a journalist, I feel like my job is to keep telling these stories, you know, and to keep seeking out these stories. And I hope that more reporters will also start to pay attention. It's always startling to me how invisible these workers really are. I'm remembering this one incident where we went to go shadow a janitor as she was cleaning a mall one morning. She started really early, about 6, finished around 10, right before the mall opened. And we were there with our cameras and our recording equipment, and I was there with my notebook. And as the people started filing into, you know, work, you know, selling watches and makeup and so on at this department store, they approached my colleagues and I and said, "Oh, what's going on here? Is this, you know, a fashion event?" And we said, "No, we're here to do a documentary about the janitor." And they all looked at us quizzically and said, "Who?" And literally, she was standing like less than 10 feet away, scrubbing, you know, a mirror. And I think that just for me spoke to how we choose not to see these workers, how their work is and their labor, which is very hard, is purposely made invisible. We ask them to work in these hours so they're not in, so they're not seen. And so I see part of my job as a reporter is to seek out those stories. And try to, you know, point some attention and spotlight toward these very hardworking individuals. I think there's obviously a lot more to be done. There's so many more industries like that that we haven't even scratched the surface. I mean, I think that it is critical that the women in Hollywood and politics and the news media have kind of, in many ways, grab that spotlight and demanded attention for it. And I think that time's up, and there have been so many efforts now, Saru being part of it, to really, you know, make sure that this conversation is far more inclusive. So there's the role of the media, but I think there's also arguably a role for all of us, you know, the general public, to say, I do care about those invisible workers, and I'm going to start paying attention to those people around me.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely, again, I want to really thank the women in Hollywood and the journalists, because they've definitely gotten a lot of critique. But I, in my experience, from the very beginning, they reached out early on, like a month or 2 months maybe after Harvey Weinstein, the whole thing blew up. They reached out to me, they reached out to Ijen from the domestic workers, obviously Monica Ramirez's amazing letter on behalf of farm worker women really kind of sparked a lot of interest. And we've, you know, I think it's, to me, that since that moment, we've been working together in meetings and events and bringing women together, actually actresses with restaurant workers and domestic workers, and letting each other hear each other's stories. We've had what we call days of witness, where people in different industries are coming together and listening to each other. And Governor Cuomo announcing that he would move one, you know, New York to one fair wage state would never have happened in a million years without that outreach from Hollywood women, without the press. And it occurred because he was at a press conference and a woman reporter asked him, "So what are you doing about sexual harassment in state government?" And he said, "You know, what are you doing about sexual harassment in the media? It's not just state government, it's every sector. You do women a disservice by asking me about sexual harassment in state government." And I think he realized that wasn't very smart for somebody running for president, or it wasn't a good response. And so a few hours later, he said, "I'm going to announce a package of anti-sexual harassment policies in the state of the state." And of course, there was none lined up. We happened to be meeting with his deputies the next day and said, here's a policy that will cut harassment in half in the industry with the highest rates of harassment. That was Friday before Christmas. Sunday before Christmas, he announced to the press that he was moving one fair wage in New York State. And that would never have happened had it not been for all the Time's Up kind of pushing. So I really see the power of women standing together across sectors. And the next step, of course, is now we're working on a joint policy agenda that would include, you know, things like what we're talking about. We're talking about going up against corporations together, you know, which would be amazing for celebrities and restaurant workers and farm workers and domestic workers to be not just naming individual bad actors, but corporate actors who've really been at the root of this. And to me, the most exciting part about the future of all of this is that we've just gotten a glimpse of what women standing together across sectors, mm-hmm. from Hollywood to the restaurant industry, the power of that. So much more could happen if what we do when we stand together is that we see all of us women in all of the sectors, from restaurant and farm work to domestic work to Hollywood, as professionals, that we're all professionals with equal value to society, that we all have something, some skills that we contribute, that we're all skilled professionals, because I've definitely heard in different contexts, oh, there's Hollywood and other professionals reaching out to the low-wage women, and that's not at all how we see our industry. We see ourselves as skilled professionals that have chosen a career in hospitality, which is a profession in other parts of the world. And same with farm work and same with domestic work. We are professionals, and the beauty and the dream of women standing together is that we could really value all of us as the professionals that we are.
So for Winnie and T, I wanted to ask you a little bit, because you've both talked a lot about law enforcement. I mean, you've reported heavily on law enforcement. And I think part of this equation is understanding how the criminal justice system deals with rape, sexual violence, and sexual assault. And I know that you have very different perspectives as a reporter who covered this incredibly unbelievable case. And as someone who had to confront the criminal justice system and some of the huge problems there head first. But I wanted to ask you what needs to change, what is changing in the criminal justice system in order to become better equipped to deal with the crime of rape and sexual assault?
Well, I mean, I'm very conscious of, and it's come to light certainly during this panel, that, you know, I have a fair amount of privilege as somebody who, you know, middle class and has a good education and was already involved in the media industry before my own rape. There's a fair amount of privilege and social cultural capital, not so much economic capital because I'm a writer, but there's a fair amount of social and cultural capital which is made it easier for me to share my story, and because, you know, I sit down and write a novel and all that, and you know, if you're a mother of five who's working, you know, shift work, you don't have the time to sit down and write a novel. So for me, it's very important to always try to use the opportunity to speak to kind of shine a light on the fact, or, you know, direct people towards the fact that, you know, I'm quite privileged, and there's lots of other people out there whose stories aren't being heard, and obviously the work that's being done here is really important to shine a light on that. And that still, and that also plays a role when you're talking about the criminal justice system, right? Because, you know, if you're middle class and well-educated, the police are probably going to believe you more. They're going to take you more seriously for whatever reason. And then even when it comes to speaking in court and trying to give your testimony, maybe you are better equipped to be speaking in a public scenario, right? Because I, you know, took debate class in high school, or things like that, right? There's all these things about, you know, the life we led before our assault, which maybe equips us better to be advocating for ourselves, and that's really quite unfair in a lot of ways, right? So I was lucky, and I didn't actually have to testify. So the morning of the trial, I'd flown over to Belfast, and 11 months had gone by of just kind of hell for me, right? Because I was expecting I was going to have to fly over to Belfast and testify in great detail about my rape in public, sitting in the same room as my perpetrator, which is terrifying, especially if you've just been through that, like, kind of trauma. So I was just dreading that, and I remember sitting, waiting for the jury to be selected, and at the last moment, the barristers came in, and they said, well, you know, there's been a change, and if you'll agree to reduce the counts that he's charged with, he will agree to plead guilty. And I just remember thinking, like, oh, what does that mean? It's, like, so legal the way you said it. And then I'm like, oh, that means I don't have to testify. So I was, like, immediately relieved, and yet at the same time, kind of quite naively, was like, oh, but I've been robbed of the chance to tell my story, right? Not that a trial is the right scenario to do that, because you're only ever answering questions that the barristers are asking you. So I decide to then imagine a trial, and that is kind of the climax of the novel. But for me, I was just aware of the fact that if I was working class, if I was an immigrant, if English was not my native language, it would have been a lot even harder for me to go and try to pursue that criminal justice process, because sitting on the stand in front of the public, telling my story of my rape would have been a terrifying ordeal. And in the UK, it's also very, very low conviction rates. It's 6% of reported rapes result in a conviction. So what are you going through all of that trauma for if the chances of actually getting justice for your perpetrator are really slim? And then if you do get justice for your perpetrator, perpetrator, like, what does that actually do for you, right? Some people, you know, I was lucky again because I had a conviction, and the rape took place in Northern Ireland. Because of Northern Ireland's history of violence, there's a bizarrely large pot of money for victims of violence out there. So I actually got, like, a large amount of compensation, but if that had happened in England, I wouldn't have gotten that. So there's all these, like, really weird inequities that happen as a result of whether or not you report, whether or not you're believed, how far the trial, what the outcome of the legal, of the legal process is. And that's also really unfair for victims, because a victim who, you know, didn't have that conviction wouldn't have access to the kind of compensation I had. So, so for me, I think with, when we're looking at the criminal justice process, we really have to look at how things like social cultural capital often impact the outcome, and also the social cultural capital of the perpetrator as well, right? What kind of defense team can they hire? I really think it shouldn't be trial by jury in these kinds of cases, because I think the public are the jury, right? And the public are so uneducated about this issue, about the way victims are supposed to behave, you know, about is she telling the truth or not? You know, there's this pervasive myth of the false rape accusation, which, you know, we see in Hollywood all the time, and that affects the way people judge a victim when she's on the stand. So I really think that, you know, we shouldn't have trial by jury. If you're going to have a jury, you have to educate them a bit more about all the different ways in which sexual trauma can affect the way a victim reacts, and the way that, and all the different ways in which perpetrators can kind of hide behind, you know, a certain veneer and still be able to commit these crimes. So that's my kind of radical suggestion. I don't know if that's ever going to change, but I do think that trial by jury is like a really problematic thing when we're looking at criminal justice.
Yeah, and I'll just say that sort of criminal justice is where you hear a lot of these issues that we've been talking about kind of intersect, right? And anybody who's looked or participated in the criminal justice system will tell you almost without exception that it's just not built for handling sexual assault cases very well. And that part of that is by design. The criminal justice system is not supposed to take into account, or has not often taken into account, the individual wishes of the individual person who's been assaulted or raped, because it's supposed to be a system which brings justice for the state. And so you will have cases where prosecutors are completely able to ignore a victim's wishes if they wish to, or they can pay close attention to the victim's wishes if they so choose. But that's really a policy by policy kind of an issue. And I think getting back to one of the things that Saru said about the systematic injustices, and this also speaks to what Winnie was saying about the jury, is that there are many, many reasons why cases don't get prosecuted. But chief among them is what they call the downstream effect, so that the first cop on the scene interviewing the victim is going to say, if I report this back up, is this going to be believed or not? Or is my sergeant going to say, like, why'd you waste your time on this woman who's a prostitute and said she was raped by a homeless person? Like, you're in the, it's too vulnerable, we'll never be able to prove that. So you as the cop may say, I'm just not going to bother to take this report. Then the sergeant, as he handles it up to the prosecutor's office, might say, there's too many holes in this case, I'm going to be embarrassed if I handle this report without doing more work, or there's not enough here, so I'm going to quash it right here. The prosecutor's going to be thinking about the jury, and he's going to say, if I bring up this vulnerable woman who has a record of doing X, Y, and Z, am I going to be able to make this case and actually charge and indict and put in prison her attacker or his attacker? So that is all thinking about the prosecutor, thinking about what he's going to look like before the judge and the jury, because ultimately it is the jury who's going to hear this evidence, and that's why you can get mistrials in the case of somebody like Bill Cosby, is because you have a jury which has not been adequately educated about what rape victims do or look like. So smart prosecutors, getting back to Winnie's point, is they'll bring in an expert who will say, you know what, sometimes women after they've been sexually assaulted will be giggly and laughy from the, and they will exchange flirty text messages. That's not that doesn't mean that you weren't raped or sexually assaulted. That's how you emotionally are reacting to that. And it's not an uncommon emotion that happens. And that really, there's no really way for a woman to react from a rape. Now, as a prosecutor, you need to bring in a victim who can educate your jury, so your jury doesn't fall back on the systematic beliefs about what sexual assault looks like in their decision-making process. So it takes a prosecutor to bring in an expert to do that. All that costs money, all that costs time, all that costs, you know, there's 8,000 other cases that they're doing on a daily basis. So to a certain extent, without very radical ideas like doing away with the jury system, the criminal system is just not set up as a loving, nurturing, restorative environment. And so many of you may have heard of the concept of restorative justice. That's another idea that's out there, which doesn't so much focus on punitive justice, but on creating a relationship, or at least an acknowledgement, an educational acknowledgement between the survivor and his or her attacker. Now, these are all out there. The restorative justice is not a hugely widely spread adopted program. The trial without jury you can do, but often defense cases don't have that happen. So there's not a big movement right now. I mean, there hasn't been a big movement for many years within law enforcement to be more victim-centered. You can only push that so far, though, before you run into the limits of the criminal justice system also is designed to protect the rights of the accused and to enforce due process. And those are the things that can seem most damaging and most negative to a victim, is to have her attacker's rights upheld in a way which he or she may feel is just kind of beyond the pale, right? So and the same thing with due process. It takes forever. You have to interview everybody else. So the criminal justice system is just never going to be the ideal place for seeking justice in the broadest sense of that term.
That's really interesting to think about in terms of what we've talked about today, in terms of systems and where we need to sort of target.
Because ultimately the criminal justice system, for better or worse, ultimately reflects us, the jury. Like, it's supposed to, right? We are the jury pool. Right. We can nullify verdicts. We can support verdicts. We can change charges. But it's ultimately, it's attenuated, certainly. But ultimately, it really comes down to what we as a society believe about rape.
Yeah, I mean, and just to add to that, I mean, that's the problem, because I get asked about restorative justice all the time, because we know the legal system often fails. But, you know, as a victim of rape, I mean, that changed my entire life, right? And, you know, I can't say that my perpetrator got, he got 8 years, and he served 4 because of this rule in Northern Ireland called 50% remission. And people often ask me, oh, are you angry about that? And I'm like, well, I don't really know. Because, like, after 4 years, I can't say my life was rebuilt, right? My life has permanently changed as a result of what that person did. There's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of financial repercussions. You know, any victim has financial repercussions, which are often not really recognized. And yet, at the same time, I'm like, but it seems quite arbitrary, because I know if that same exact crime had been tried in America, he would have gotten a much longer sentence. In another country, would have probably even gotten a shorter sentence. And yet, I also know that most victims out there don't even have a conviction, so their perpetrators aren't even in jail. So it seems so completely arbitrary for me to even make a judgment call on that. But at the same time, we're talking about a crime that fundamentally changes a victim's life, and there should be some form of kind of punishment for that. And yet, what is the correct punishment? It's kind of impossible to come up with a system that seems fair.
Yeah, I just want to point out that Tarana Burke, who founded Me Too, you know, came at it very much like Me Too was before all of this for decades, very much about restorative justice, redemption, and healing, because it was about women of color experiencing assault and being victimized by men of color and not wanting to actually use the criminal justice system at all, but actually figure out this healing that really needs to occur among individuals who are part of a system that has created the structures that allow this to happen, that facilitate this happening. And so, you know, that's definitely how we see this work. There's been so much calling out, even in our industry, of individual chefs and individual employers, and it's just so, it's great. Women need to come forward and call out individual employers, and it's a very redemptive moment for our industry. For all my talk to you today about the National Restaurant Association, we have had so many restaurant owners and even one or two chains come to us, sit down with us and say, we want to work with you now. You know, we've realized things have been so messed up for so long. Our industry's the worst. And we're actually working with some employers, some of whom have been very guilty, to help them overhaul their entire companies. And so for us, we really believe in redemptive and restorative justice, so much so that the thing is to work with those that are willing to change. We call them taking the high road to profitability, and still fight the accountable, which is not individuals, but the structures and the corporate actors that are creating the system. And so just as an example, since we're in the Bay Area, we partnered with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, which has been working to end mass incarceration for a long time and leading a group on restorative justice, bought a building right across from the Fruitvale BART station called Restore Oakland, where in the bottom floor we're going to have, we own restaurants around the country that are training centers for low-wage workers. We're going to have our largest Colors restaurant training center where we'll train lots of women, formerly incarcerated individuals, immigrants, in their rights and organizing. And the second floor is all restorative justice activity. So we're really combining economic justice, restorative justice, really working on these issues together as a model for the Bay Area to then replicate for the rest of the country in a project called Restore Oakland. So for us, this is front and center. Front and center is let's figure out how to do redemptive work, restorative work with individuals while we're fighting the systems.
And I think that, I think if we're talking about whether or not the Me Too movement has gone too far, I think the consensus might be not by a long shot, in terms of it's not just about naming a few bad apples, but a much deeper systemic journey that we've really only barely scraped the surface of. But I wanted to open it up to you if you have any questions for these amazing panelists. There will be a microphone at the house left, so sort of where I'm pointing right there. There we go. So if you can, I don't know if you want to come up to the microphone. Yeah, and we'll have some time for some questions.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for all your comments. It's just been great. I guess I have a big concern that people are already getting sick of this. And how do we keep it fresh? You know, people are like, okay, yeah, this Me Too stuff, I'm sick of it. And now there's the backlash that from men, like, oh, well, we've heard enough. And you know, I was a farm worker and a motel maid and a waitress, you know, and I know all the stuff that happened 50 years ago, and I see the same stuff happening today. So it's a very, very slow, you know, this is great, this is Me Too, but it's been going on a long time. It's going to take a long time to fix it because of all the structural things that are in place. But I'm worried that people are sick of it, and that's the kind of backlash I'm getting. I recently wrote my own book about my own story, and it's like, oh, phew, that, you know, everybody said that. Everybody's had that happen. We're bored with it. The press is bored with it. How are we going to keep it in if everybody's sick of it? And now men are saying that, oh, it's too much. It's just women are talking too much. This is ridiculous.
Right. So is there, I mean, do you guys think that there is a sort of a possibility of this slipping away because of a pushback against that Me Too is too much?
Well, I'll just say really quickly from a reporting journalist perspective, yes, I think arguably some editors, some publications are starting to get Me Too fatigue. Thankfully, my news organization has not, and I have been charged with continuing to, you know, charge forward with this type of coverage. But I think maybe where we could do better and where I've been really trying to focus and where I think my book focuses quite a good bit is on, you know, responses and solutions and efforts to address this from organizations and workers and worker advocacy groups. I think it's hard to constantly look at the problem and be kind of hit with the problem again and again and again without having some sense for how we're actually addressing the problem and how we're being proactive around it. And I think, you know, hearing what Saru was just talking about, you know, Restore Oakland, that sounds like a story to me, yeah. You know? And so these are the types of things where there's a kind of interesting symbiotic relationship between the work that is being done by the advocates and then us making sure as reporters that we're tracking that work and that we're chronicling it incrementally as change and as efforts are happening. And I think that's maybe where there's more space to keep pushing.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I would encourage the media, you know, I think, you know, I know it's not the people on this panel, but there's sometimes you're looking for the salacious, for the tension, for the conflict, for the drama, right, in reporting. And I would argue that right now, beyond the tension and conflict of drama of a perpetrator and a victim, there is enormous tension, as I was trying to describe, between people standing up right now against the most powerful, you know, corporate and elite actors in America, including our president, and being attacked, being counterattacked, being oppressed, and still continuing in their courageous ways to stand up. That those things, I think, the more that we can, yes, push out solutions, employers who are, you know, and lift up employers who are actually doing the right thing, and at the same time cover the fight, cover the struggle that's actually going on that nobody's covering. To me, that's the way to overcome fatigue. I agree that we're not going to be able to just keep telling victim stories. We're just not. What we need to now cover is victims turning into protagonists, victims turning into activists and advocates and leaders in their own struggle, and how they're being attacked and how they're pushing back.
I mean, for me, if I were a journalist, I mean, one of the questions, that's an interesting question, like, why are people getting sick of this? Like, I mean, it's obvious for me as a survivor and, you know, everybody here on this panel that we need to be talking about these stories, but if there is this pervasive attitude among a certain part of the population that we're getting sick of this, like, that is worth investigating. Like, why... Right. Why is there a malaise? Like, why is there such little empathy for fellow human beings? And is that part of a spectrum of a lack of empathy because so many people are selfish and self-centered and don't care really if it doesn't bother them or it doesn't impact them? So I think that kind of like lack of empathy and that sort of attitude of not really wanting to change things because why does it need to change because it doesn't affect me, that really needs to be looked at. And I think I would encourage journalists to try to look at that as well and put that in dialogue with the kind of work that's being done by activists and survivors.
Yeah. Sorry, I had to say one more thing. I mean, it's been amazing the coverage of the Parkland survivors standing up and fighting. And can you think of similar stories of women survivors standing up and fighting, and there just aren't as many, and that's what I would love to see, because there is a movement, it's happening, there's women standing together across sectors doing incredible things. I'm a part of it, I can tell you, it's incredible, and it's not being covered.
I'll just say really, really quickly, not to defend the worst practice of the press, but especially in today, much more so than when I began, publishers are driven by clicks and by interest, and they read those. And so when you see people talking about fatigue or burnout, you are seeing a reflection of the reading audience as well, who is, for whatever reason, the reading public. It's much easier for us now as journalists to know the reading public is interested in this story because now they're interested in North Korea. Or now they're interested in the Parkland, the gun violence shooting. There's a lot of issues that this president generates to cover on a daily basis. So I would say, in part, this again, like I always get a little bit nervous when we're talking about sort of systematic things because that kind of tends to blur the issue that the people run those systems. They're not like robots operating on their own. And when you talk about institutional or systematic problems, you are talking about the people who run those institutions that are doing the oppressing. And so to take your, so the idea that you would focus less on those, I think is where you should focus sort of more of the attention on. It's sort of, the way you attract people in is by telling stories about fights, telling stories about people interacting, telling stories about striving for emotional justice. Person A fighting against nameless, faceless corporation or government agency is not, nearly as interesting.
Yeah, no, sorry. I wasn't saying name the heads of the corporations. I was just saying let's name the heads of the corporations.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's go ahead and do it because journalists are, we're not academics. We're trying to tell stories that engage people, and we are a business. And so my master's, not actually at ProPublica, but in previous places I've worked, certainly pay very close attention to how many people are reading what stories because we are a business. We're trying to sell ads and clicks, right? So as those disappear, that the fate of the Me Too movement, to a certain extent, depends upon the fate of the engagement of the reading public.
I just want to say, great panel. This question is really for Saru and Bernice. I write about the sex industries, and I write about women organizing within the sex industries and, you know, fighting corporations and wealth redistribution. And I'm really interested in just where, and any stuff that you all know about in terms of looking at sexual harassment in the sex industries, which is complicated for a whole lot of reasons. And also, I'm really curious about, Saru, if there's any work being done or data in those places that overlap with the restaurant industry, like Hooters and places like that, where you're going to have both the restaurant problems and some of the sex industry problems. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, so in 2014, we put out this report called The Glass Floor. We surveyed hundreds of workers across America, actually train workers again, to survey each other, together with Ford Together. And, you know, that story kind of, for us, broke the... It was what really opened up the dialogue around sexual harassment in our industry. And right around the same moment that that came out, the industry was dumb enough to announce a new recognized industry segment called the breastaurant. It is a new recognized industry segment. You will see it. I get regularly Nation's Restaurant News, which is the trade mag, and they'll they'll report on the breastaurant. The breastaurant segment is doing blah blah blah, and it's not. It used to be three top companies: Hooters, Tilted Kilt, and a really fast-growing chain called Twin Peaks. And now it's Olive Garden and IHOP and Denny's that are considered restaurants. So I don't see that much of a separation between the sex industry and the restaurant industry. We've been working with a group of women waitresses at a very high-profile Beverly Hills restaurant where Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone go every single day. And horrible harassment and assault. And one of the waitresses told me, and I've been working in restaurants since I was 16, my first day on the job, my manager tells me, wear lipstick. And I said, why? Why do I have to wear lipstick? And she said, well, you do know that you're just one step away from a prostitute, right, as a waitress. That's your job. You're supposed to sell your body. That's what you're supposed to do. And every day, managers are telling women, dress more sexy, show your breasts, you know, and if you get grabbed, that's what you want. Thank goodness you're still young and you can get grabbed because that's what you want, you know? So I think there's just it's not two industries. It's really one industry, and we're starting to document women, young women who start out in restaurants, go to Hooters, go to stripping, and some end up being trafficked, and it is a very common kind of pathway, you know, for a lot of women. So we're talking about kind of one phenomenon of very exploited labor, you know, providing sexual pleasure for men, and we need to really stand together, and it's a lot of the same issues, you know, pay, respect, we're professionals, you know, we should be valued for what we do, and work together. I don't know if I answered your question, but...
I had a manager once tell me that it was tits for tips.
Yep, that's what it is. It's tits for tips.
Bernice.
I think I am aware, and I actually get press releases regularly on this issue, and I think on a totally pragmatic level, kind of what T was saying earlier, you know, you have sometimes cops who think, well, you know, a prostitute who's been sexually assaulted by a homeless person, you know, it's just too hard of a case to look into, so let's just not make a report at all. I think that's in many respects what happens in journalism with this same topic, you know. It's a complicated story to tell. You have to just decide that you're going to do it and then embrace the complexity and really unpack the complexity. And I can't say that I have personally gone there yet, but I certainly have been getting these press releases. They're you know, you're pulling string, things are going in the back of your mind about how you might be able to develop it over time. But I think, you know, being able to draw connections with, say, the restaurant work, with trafficking, looking for patterns of bad behavior in certain places, you know, a lot of the action research that some organizations have done, you know, all of those puzzle pieces you start to put together. Sometimes it takes longer, you know, for more complicated stories like that, you know, to realize a journalistic piece. But you know, those are certainly the things that I'm looking for. Because, yes, it's obviously, you know, you can imagine these are some of the most vulnerable workers when it comes to sexual assault. Yeah. So we should be paying attention.
And unfortunately, I know that there's still questions there, but we're going to have to leave it there. I think we could probably go on for about 7 more hours plus with this topic. But I want to thank so much the panelists who were so amazing today. And I want to tell y'all that you can get their books out in the lobby. I was lucky enough to read all of their books. I don't advise reading them all at the same time, which I did, because then you'll be feverishly checking all of your doors and locks, especially the same week that, you know, the Golden State Killer gets caught. So these books are amazing. They're beautifully written. They're absolutely poignant. They are also important. So I can't recommend them enough. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.